You're back with Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner. Green lawns and golf courses are often blamed for the growing water crisis in the West. But National Geographic Explorer-in-Residence Wade Davis says the real culprit is beef. Cows eating alfalfa in a place where he thinks neither belongs, the Colorado River Basin. Davis uncovers other surprising things as he follows the Colorado literally and figuratively in his new book, River Notes. Wade, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Ryan.
This book is part travelogue, part history of a river that millions of people rely on for water and recreation. But hundreds of years ago, only Native Americans knew about it. And you write that the Paiutes used songs to find their way through the Grand Canyon. Tell us about the Paiute's relationship to the Colorado River.
Well, the Paiute, like all the First Nations who lived in the environs of the Grand Canyon, had their own kind of mythological sense of the place, their own sense of its inherent sacredness, if you will. But what they shared in common was this conviction that the land as it was perfect, as it had been created at the time of its origins. And that fundamental idea was so different than the ideology of transformation that was brought to the American West with the arrival of Europeans, and most particularly with the hegira of the Mormons, who literally went west with the clear desire to transform the great American desert, to create a new Jerusalem, and to green the desert.
I mean, this is really the contrast that your book begins with. Fundamentally, the native people see the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon as just fine, thank you. And then you get early Mormon settlers who really see this as needing transformed. I was so struck in the book by the fact that there was actually a belief that if you came west, you know, to this arid place and you turned the soil, that the rain would come. That was a belief people held.
Yeah, it was promoted with the kind of rigor of scientific orthodoxy. I mean, part of what sparked all of this was this dream of Zion, of the Mormons. Don't forget that there's an interesting reason that Brigham Young settled in the Salt Lake and he didn't go on to the Willamette Valley in Oregon or the more fertile lands of California. It was that if they could somehow transform that desert, it was kind of like a coefficient for everything they had suffered in the East with their provocative new religious ideas. And if they could somehow make that desert bloom, it would, in a sense, rationalize all the suffering they had endured at the hands of others. And, of course, they did, within short order, bring 2 million acres in the Great Salt Lake area into cultivation, and that became the model for the West.
And, of course, today we see the results of this transformation all up and down the Colorado from, gosh, Hoover Dam to Glen Canyon Dam to Lake Mead, Lake Powell.
Well, it's got to be one of the most regulated rivers on Earth, and it's been so cannibalized by human usage that, of course, it reaches the ocean, a river only in name, a shadow in the sand, a stark, barren delta, which was once one of the most fertile places for fauna and flora in all of North America.
And if you really want to see the transformation of the Colorado, one of the places with the starkest before and after, I suppose, is the Delta. What it was then, what it is now. I'd love to have you read for us, Wade, a description of the Delta as it once was, before damming, before the transformation of the Colorado. Would you do that for us?
Sure. You know, one of the things that's so extraordinary is, you know, the fluidity of our memory and our capacity to forget as a species. And Aldo Leopold, sort of the father of the environmental movement, as recently as 1922, now that's in the lifetime of my own father, paddled throughout this verdant delta. And it was remarkable what he saw. And this is a little passage. "Drifting with the ebb and flow of the tides, waking by dawn to the whistles of quail roosting in the branches of mesquite trees, making camp on mudflats etched with the tracks of wild boar, yellow legs, and jaguar, the Leopold brothers experienced the Colorado Delta much as had the Spanish explorer, Hernando de Alcaron, who first reached its shores in 1540. There were bobcats draped over cottonwood snags, deer, raccoons, beavers, and coyotes, and flocks of birds so abundant they darkened the sky. Avocets and willets, mallards, widgeons, and teals, scores of cormorants, screaming gulls, and so many egrets in the wing that Leopold compared them in flight to a premature snowstorm.
this image of a flock of birds being so enormous that it looks like a snowstorm. I mean, you just get the sense that the Delta is teeming with life. And contrast that, Wade, for what the Delta looks like today. You've seen it up close. It was part of your journey.
Well, the Delta today is a wasteland with no sign that anything living was ever there, except for the sort of scabrous, leprous trees that are salt-resistant, the weeds and so on, except for one golden place of regeneration, and that's the Cienega del Santa Clara. And this is an extraordinary story, because once we turned off the river like a tap, not just with the construction of the Hoover Dam, but the subsequent construction of the Glen Canyon Dam, we thought the Delta was gone forever. But in the 1970s, Mexico began to complain about the intensity of the salinity of the allocation of the water that was flowing their way according to the original agreements of 1922.
Because what was left was just of really poor quality.
It was a very poor quality, and so we offered to build what became the biggest desalination plant in history. And as part of that project, we diverted some of the water flow into the Delta and kind of dumped it there. And the incredible thing is what they've discovered is just how little water would be necessary to bring back the core of the Delta to life.
You're listening to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner, and Wade Davis, who's an explorer in residence with the National Geographic Society, is with us. His new book is called River Notes, A Natural and Human History of the Colorado. And when you talk about where the water of the Colorado is going, you say that it really comes down to cows eating alfalfa in a landscape where neither belongs. It's not swimming pools.
No, it's not swimming pools. I mean, if you think about it, you know, the Bureau of Land Management is to the landmass of the West what the Bureau of Reclamation is to water resources. And they oversee roughly 350 million acres, 250 million acres of which are given over to cattle production. But that total acreage produces less than 10% of America's cattle production. So what this implies is that we are compromising these rivers to produce a relatively small percentage of our beef production. And what's more, in order to revitalize the Delta itself, the core of the Delta, all we would actually need, besides the will of the people and the cooperation of politicians, is the water that now goes to support a third of 1% of the nation's cattle production.
You pointed a finger at cattle, and I also think of ranchers who are really of their own lands quite conscientious stewards. You know, it's been ranchers often that help keep land conserved in the West.
What I'm saying is not to in any way denigrate ranchers or the great tradition of ranching in the American West. And indeed, many, as you say, ranchers have, you know, in terms of easements and in terms of local conservation initiatives, have led the way on conservation efforts. You know, a storyteller and a scientist, in some sense, your obligation is not to try to change the world, but to bear witness to it. And in a way, what this book simply tries to say is there's a choice we have. You can identify where this water is going. You can identify what the cost has been to the river, to the estuary. You have a societal choice you can make. And the obvious solution is some limitation on the growth of cattle in these places where the production is just so inefficient.
You know, you did a lot of research into the Colorado, into how it's been transformed. And my sense is that you did that research before you took your trip down the Colorado. And so when you finally do embark down the Colorado for a river trip, you expect in a way to be disappointed, to even be disgusted on the trip. And still, the river and the canyon amaze you.
Yeah, that's such a nice point, Ryan. You know, I am a professional whitewater guide in Canada, and you know, in Canada, we are fortunate that most of our rivers run free. I mean, our greatest canyon, for example, that of the Stikine River, in all of history has never seen a raft make it through. In all of history, less than 100 people have managed to get through what is known generally as the K2 of whitewater challenges. In the Colorado, of course, I had read that flow was controlled by technicians at dams, that 27,000 people went down it every year. What could be left, I thought, of the wild character of a place where park rangers control every movement? And I discovered that this remained, despite the extent to which the river has been compromised by humans, it remains one of the most glorious and legendary river trips, transformative in every way.
Before we go, I have to know what it means to hold the title National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and how I get that job.
You know, it's a wonderful gig. I guess it's like being an adult in a sandbox. I've had a lot of fun. You know, it started about 12 years ago when the Society moved into its second century and redefined its fundamental mission as from telling you about the world to helping you save the world. So they selected 7 individuals to kind of personify that new mission. Jane Goodall for primatology and Bob Ballard for deep ocean archaeology, who found the Titanic, and a number of other wonderful colleagues of mine. And I was just very fortunate to be recruited as a social anthropologist, really with the mission to draw attention to the plight of indigenous cultures, to the erosion of linguistic diversity, to the terrible fact that in losing in a generation half the languages of the world, we're losing half of humanity's social, spiritual, ecological knowledge.
Well, thank you so much for exploring the river with us.
My pleasure, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Wade Davis is an explorer in residence at National Geographic. His new book is called River Notes, A Natural and Human History of the Colorado.